Welcome to the Borderless Podcast, your guide to traveling, investing, and living beyond borders, where we talk about living the life that you want to live, where you want to live it.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Today, I'm going to speak to Miles Wakeham, and he's lived around the world. He's started businesses and now is a real estate investor. He was down here in San Miguel de Allende, so I thought I'd invite him over to talk about different ways of making money, cryptocurrencies, real estate investment, all kinds of things like that. I think you'll enjoy the conversation. I will warn you that by the end of the conversation, one of our mics went out. And so if you're watching this online, then one of the videos also went out. So you'll see that the recording of Miles, you couldn't hear so well, but I still kept it on there in case you wanted to hear it. But I will warn you, sorry about that. But yeah, so I think you'll enjoy it. Before we get started, I did want to say two things. Number one, please go to Telegram if you're a Telegram user, to Borderless Blog. I've started a channel there trying to get more and more people over there. I'd like to get more concentrated on Telegram rather than Facebook. I just don't even get traction on Facebook, and I'd rather use Telegram. So if you could, please go over there. If you're not on Telegram, you should do it. And also, I want to announce a page that I put together, borderlesshealthinsurance.com. If you or anybody you know is looking for health insurance, I have a page there with a video that kind of goes through the basics of international health insurance for expats, digital nomads, and like to help anybody that is looking for that. It's another way that you can help the show. If you like this content, I can do more of it. If I can get, you know, I'd rather not have people donate. So if I can just have affiliates and other ways that I can have drive people to the websites, that that will help me out. So thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the podcast. And here we go. Borderless. All right, everybody. Welcome to another Borderless podcast. This is, of course, your host, James Guzman. And we are here in San Miguel de Allende, and I'm here with Mr. Miles Unconstrained, Miles. How you doing?
Good. How are you, mate?
Good. So excellent. I've been on your podcast, and you're down here hanging out in San Miguel, so I thought I'd bring you on. I think you have a lot to offer. And, well, first of all, maybe just briefly kind of go over, I haven't had you on before, so what you're about or your history, that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, I'm originally from Australia, and my accent kind of gives that away. Mm-hmm. I moved to the United States when I was 25. I was not a typical US-raised person, so I didn't go to college. I didn't even finish high school. I landed in Los Angeles unexpectedly, and one thing led to another, and surprisingly, I got married before I was 25.
Oh, wow.
And then
Sorry? Me too.
Me too, right. The weird thing was I entered the U.S. immigration system as a new citizen, and that has a whole process of things you have to go through on the way into the United States. It took about 6 months before I got a work permit, so I found myself living around Los Angeles, bumming around, not knowing what to do, couldn't work. I'm a musician originally, and so I ended up stumbling into every guitar store in the in the San Fernando Valley, and seeing all these ads for, you know, bands with, you know, players wanted. I'm a guitarist, so I said I saw, you know, guitarists wanted for whatever, and I had nothing else to do, so I called them up and said, you know, I'd try out for a band or whatever. And long story short, I ended up getting into a band that did pretty well, and then one thing led to another, and I ended up, the band broke up, and I ended up working as a record producer, as a recording engineer for Capitol Records for a while. But that was all good from the point of view of my artistic needs in the States, but it didn't pay the bills, not enough anyway. And so I ended up getting a job for a little startup out in Thousand Oaks that did some medical thing I didn't understand. And little did I know, I'd walked into what became the world's largest biotechnology corporation, which was Amgen, about a few months before they got their first approval for their first product. So I got interviewed in these like mobile trailer park offices they had, because they hadn't even built any buildings. And they gave you a ton of these things they called stock options, which I didn't even know what they were. I said, sure, whatever, just give me a job, you know. And 5 years later, I let him vest, and I walked away from there a millionaire. So it was kind of an unusual act of situation.
Yeah.
But I got a phone call that my mother had had a car accident in Australia and I had to go back. So I went back, and that was weird, because leaving the United States to exit was, for me, it wasn't hard because I was going back to my home country. But my wife at the time, she had not really experienced that life of an expat. For her, it was an expat. For me, it was going back home. And as a result of a whole bunch of things, the marriage didn't work, got divorced. And then I found myself in this really weird situation where everything that I had worked hard for and learnt and amassed as wealth pretty much was taken from me. I lost half of it in the divorce. Then one thing, I had this weird situation where I had a major car accident in the outback in Australia, and unfortunately somebody died in our car, and I was left with half of my body was destroyed. And the result of that was that I went into the Australian socialized medical system, which pretty much let me down. The way they worked is that because the driver of the car was not really that heavily injured, and he had hit, it was a long story. It was a major accident, and his girlfriend was in the front of the car. She was killed. I was in the back of the car. Because her family went after him for like on a negligent homicide charge, which was not the case at all, but they were distraught, and I understand that. Well, all the insurance was nullified because they thought this was a criminal act. It wasn't a normal state. And so for years, they wouldn't pay the insurance. So I got the basic kind of almost military grade level triage, but never the right care to try to actually repair the damage that was done. And it took me 8 years to fight them legally eventually to get that. In the meantime, I kind of realized just how bad socialized medicine was. But as it happened, I remarried. We had a daughter. And then 5 or so years later, I guess I returned back to the States. And again, it was kind of bittersweet, because on the one hand, I liked to be back in the United States, but I came just like I came in the first time, with just a suitcase of clothes and a whole bunch of hope and wishes and hoping that I can make a go of it. And surprisingly, I did. 5 years later, I got back to the same status I'd left the country before by using real estate this time.
Yeah.
Then 2008 happened. So I'm kind of like Mr. Zero to Hero to Zero to Hero to Zero kind of journey. And then I realized in 2008, we had a lot of rental properties. We had geared a lot of them fairly high, many of them not so bad. But I had some properties overseas that I was able to sell and cash out. And by using that technique and bolstering the debt load in the U.S., I was able to amass, to settle all of our real estate. And they still had a big ton of cash. And so I started realizing everybody else was out there getting foreclosed. So I wandered down to, I lived in Arizona. I wandered down in Phoenix to the county auctions. And it was like going back to the old gold rush times. You know, there'd be in this open town square and some guy with a cowboy hat would be out there. Who wants to buy this? Who wants to buy that? Yeah, I'll have that. Yeah, I'll have that. I'll have that. I'll have that. I just bought whatever I could. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, my wife and I got in the business of turning them back into rentable properties. We did that. We amassed about 25 doors, something like that. And then everything sort of settled. Economically, the world kind of got back on track again. And meanwhile, these properties went up 5 times what I paid for them. Yeah. So to this day now, I realize that you can go through some pretty hellish times in your life, but it's up to the individual to recover from it. And once you've done that, the way I looked at it when 2008 happened, nothing could be as bad as what the crap that I'd been through before. So I settled into the mode of just becoming Mr. Landlord, and we've been living on our rents pretty much ever since.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. You know, I have a lot of people that, have gotten financial freedom through real estate. I think it's a really great way to do it, and it's kind of tried and true. Although now, in the U.S. has been really, although you can do a lot of different things overseas, you don't have the benefit of the 30-year fixed mortgage, which is basically subsidized by the federal government. And that's really the asset that you have, these days, when you're buying, is that
that 30-year fixed mortgage, which you can't get overseas. You know, there's ways that you can play the game overseas. A lot of people do, you know, flipping or stuff like that, but you really need to have cash.
Right.
But a lot of people, you know, especially to get started, Americans, they or, you know, you've done it, is in the United States. And, you know, right now it just seems to be really crazy. I really don't know what's going to happen with the mortgage market. I mean, they can't keep these moratoriums going on forever. Do you have that problem? Do you have people not paying?
I was raised as a young, in my teenage years, as kind of as a like self-styled hustler businessman, which I preferred, to be honest. And so I know how to negotiate and I know how to make a deal work for somebody. And where, you know, I've had tenants call me up and say, look, I lost my job. I have no money. I'm going to get evicted. What am I going to do? It's easier for a landlord, even in a state like Arizona, where we get a 97% success rate on evicting a tenant and get a property back in 3 weeks.
Even now with the moratorium?
Not with the moratorium, yeah. No, but in normal times.
Okay.
Even in those times, I always found it easier to negotiate.
Just talk.
Yeah. And
person to person.
Look, I don't believe in counterparties. I think that the world would be a far better place if we all were able to work peer to peer. And in that way, I'm not a fan of government. I'm not a fan of courts. I'm not a fan of banks. To me, peer to peer is where it's at. And if I can do that with a tenant and I can help them solve a problem that's a win for them and make it a win for me.
Sure.
It's always worked out better for me that way. And when I've got a tenant who's down on their luck and they can't work, okay, what can you do? Yeah. Well, I used to work in construction. Really? I need to get a roof fixed.
Yeah.
I'll pay, you know, that sort of thing, right? And I can find a way to make it work. And we've done that. And thankfully, we've never evicted a tenant in the last 3 years, all through the pandemic. And even while the moratorium is on, every tenant of mine is paid 100% upfront.
Okay. And, you know, but I'm thinking about the market overall. I mean, do you have any predictions? I mean, have you thought about that? I don't know what's going to happen. You know what I mean? It just seems so. How are they going to unwind themselves out of this? Not only are they paying people these enhanced unemployment for over a year now, but, you know, you can't evict people. So, you know, they're having a boost stimulus, whatever you want to call it, of not having to pay their rent. And so I've been trying to think about how that's going to, because it can't last forever. At some point in time, they're going to have to uplift this. People are going to have to pay their, unless they nationalize the mortgage industry or something. I don't know. Have you ever thought about that, about what might happen with
all that? Well, I hope not. I mean, the one thing about real estate, which is an unusual situation, it's one of the last actual free market bastions we've got in the economy.
Mm.
Pricing is based on supply and demand and, you know,
how
much supply, what are people willing to pay? It's not based on some fictitious computer program or commodities broker on Wall Street that predicts the market price. It's actually real life. It's still like that. It's the exception. And the problem is that the government might consider that by stepping in as a counterparty and trying to balance it out, that they could take the burden off the tenant, which, let's face it, there's more of them voting than there are landlords. And they could prop up the tenant in order to protect the landlord and everybody wins. Well, the problem with that is the second they do that, there are all these conditions. And the conditions are, well, if we pay the rent of the tenant instead of the tenant to try to prop the market up, or we pay their, you know, give them a certain amount of money for their first time home buyers or whatever, we're distorting the market.
They're doing a new round of that. I saw this in the stimulus. Yeah, $10,000, I think. Yeah.
And in fact, it was well advertised under Biden's financial policy during his election period that he wanted to do away with the 1031 exchange.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to really do away with capital gains tax.
Yep.
He wants to give first-time home buyers, you know, a ton of money. He wants to make sure that tenants never have to pay more than 30% of their gross income in their rent.
Right.
If they intervene into a market which itself has been the last bastion of the free market, it's all bets are off, because I can't predict future pricing. And we're not in the business of fix and flip.
Mm-hmm.
We're fix and hold landlords. But it's very hard, because you don't get rewarded with when you're being told that if you make more, you know, sell something that's worth more than, say, $1 million, you're not going to be able to get capital gains tax. And then maybe your original plan, your your whole portfolio of properties were based on the fact that you could buy them here, sell them there, pay this amount of capital gains tax, move on to the next. If that was your plan, which unfortunately was the case for most real estate speculators and developers, it's all bets are off.
Right.
So I don't know where this ends up. It kind of feels like the private market will pull out of real estate, and the only person to come back in and fill that void will be the government.
Government or big crony corporations.
Yeah, like your BlackRock.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I definitely want to talk to you about, that's how you have been able to get your location independent income, I suppose. And so I like to talk about different ways that are able to do it. Like I said, a lot of people do real estate that has worked. But also in your podcast, you talk about personal finance in general.
Right.
And, I don't know if there's any kind of like basic roadmap. I know that you talk about the stages of life. Mm-hmm. And so, because this is one thing, this is the biggest stumbling block for most people when they want to go international, live borderlessly. The first thing is getting that location independent income, getting financially independent. So what would you say, or kind of how do you recommend people approach that, getting their income going?
Many moons ago, I sort of realized that if I was going to be living in a way that I had to be partially in Australia, partially in the United States, I had to find a way to do that, find a way to kind of digitize my life at the time. Now, my background is as a software developer, so these things are not alien to me. But I did realize that it's very, very hard to, it used to be, if you were in that situation, you would have to sell everything up in one place, cash out at the, cash all your chips out at the casino, completely get rid of everything you've got, and then move to the next place. It was a leap of faith, and it required an investment. And I remember the second time, that I brought my family back to the States, it took me 12 months to recover from all of the things that I needed to reestablish myself. Buying cars, I couldn't use credit, I had to pay cash. Rentals, they wanted 3 months of rent deposit up front. Furniture, I could, it was cheap. It was not cheap to rent furniture. And, that stuff cost a lot of money to do. And I had to devote the first year of my entire income to fund that.
Yeah.
What would have been so much easier, which I learned later, is if I had had an ongoing sustainable income stream coming from where I came from that gave me the freedom to move to where I wanted to go to. Well, it's easy to stretch upon that premise. I call that financial sustainability. It's easy to stretch that premise out by saying, well, what if you had that, but you never left where you were? Because then it changes something which is such an important part and such a, I would say, a societal disappointment in the US. Statistics in the US are nasty. And if somebody was to tell me all of these numbers that come out of like US Bureau of Labor Statistics or the CDC about things like life expectancy and things like how many people are able to retire, how many people are living paycheck to paycheck? And you start looking at these statistics. If you were to rattle those off, they'd think you are some sort of conspiracy nut. Because nobody could believe you when they said that 78% of everybody earning less than $100,000 in the US are living paycheck to paycheck. But it's true.
Yeah.
Nobody would tell you that only maybe 35% of people who reach the age of 65 can afford to retire. But it's true. And nobody will tell you that the life expectancy in the United States dropped by 5 years in the last 5 years.
Mm.
But it's true. I don't make these numbers up. These are like CDC numbers.
Mm.
And we have a society that's living on a 20th century mantra of how long people live, how much, put your money in the 401k and the IRA and put all your faith in that and you'll be just fine. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
When I started realizing that if I could generate the cash flow I needed, the income I needed to meet my day-to-day expenses, what I call my burn rate. I never had to work another day in my life again if I made sure that the way I was making that money didn't involve my labor. And then I looked at one thing and I said, There's one thing that's true about people who are rich. They don't have jobs. And when I realize that, I think, you know, I look at the yachts in Monaco Harbor and the Swiss guys and the uber rich. They don't have jobs.
Right.
You know, and anybody who thinks that they're going to be rich by having a job.
Right.
I mean, everybody knows that, right? Even my accountant tells me that. Well, yeah, don't have a job. Buy assets. And what are you going to buy? You're going to buy assets that generate cash that don't require a huge amount of labor to maintain them. So I looked at what classes of assets fit that mold. Real estate does. Vending machines do. Digital assets like web applications, websites, things like that. Those sorts of things. Dividend stock, annuities. I mean, anything that generates cash doesn't require your time. People do that when they retire. They get to 65, they get their big payout. Well, they buy annuities or they buy things that just pay them the money until the day they die. How about we do that when we're 25, right? We don't need to wait that long. If we define that our life is a life of purpose and it's something that we all have the right to enjoy, and we take the same approach that a 65-year-old would take, but at 25... you can do it. And yeah, look, it's tough. Everyone will say to me, yeah, but Miles, I can't get a house. I can't afford this. I've got a job, all this stuff. You know what? That was a choice. Every single one of those things there is a choice.
Yeah.
And if you can't see that as a problem, that you made the choice, you can also undo the choice. One of the most valuable things that people who travel, who come here, they start understanding the idea of arbitrage. The money they make in the United States, which is quite buoyant, versus their expense costs when they're overseas, and how they get to keep what they earn. And we live in a society that never taught anybody this in college or even in home ec and in high right. school. It's not what you earn, it's what you keep.
Yeah.
And if people start realizing that if they can live relatively frugally at a young age, earn as much as they possibly can, but whatever they do, and this is where I have, there are many people out there that kind of preach that model, people in, the FIRE movement, for example. And this is where I break completely apart with these guys. They would say, do that, which I'm on board with doing that, but then take the money, the profits, and put it into like Vanguard index funds or passive investments here or whatever. Why don't you just give it to somebody behind the curtain? You worked hard for the money. You're going to give it to the guy over there you can't see. The government is going to take it from you. That, you know, no. How about you take some responsibility for it and you hold your assets?
Okay. So what would you recommend other than that?
Well, the first thing, real estate, obviously, because you can touch it, right? Physical. Right. The second thing would be something like precious metals, like gold, yeah. Silver.
Well, that's not going to give you income, though.
No, but it will protect your money.
Right.
So if you're not looking for an income stream, but you're looking for an insurance policy.
Financial insurance is how it is.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then probably, I mean, look, I started down the road of cryptocurrency back in 2011.
Right.
I did it more as a technical experience. And these days, I think it's kind of lost its path.
Mm.
But despite that, it is a way that you could potentially use things like DeFi mm-hmm. as a way to generate passive income off crypto assets. To a point, I've been burnt by that before, I'll admit to that, but I'll say that it's an emerging possibility, although I think there are a lot of traps. So I'm not advocating it, but I'm saying that there are ways of getting smart income without you having to extend labor to do it.
Yeah, it's kind of tough right now in just, you know, the regular assets that we all normally think of. I mean, for everybody, you know, I think it's like, what could you put your money in that's cheap right now or that's a really good deal? I mean, there's not a whole lot, I guess, you know, a lot of people are saying copper, you know, some other commodities, obviously, you know, we're looking at inflation. And so it's really a big question. But, you know, I think that in a lot of ways, you can look at just your normal standard assets. But maybe, you know, it's time to also look at local things, you know, investing in local businesses, people you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you know anything about a certain asset class, whether it's cars or jewelry or something like that,
right?
I mean, perhaps that's not going to get you cash flow, but you know, something that's going to hold its value. It's just right now, it's very uncertain times. I think that we're really going into type, you know, some kind of a you know, an acceleration of something. And you know, I think that we're going to see a lot of battles. You know, you mentioned crypto. You know, I talk to people all day about this on both sides of the issue. And I think what it's going to boil down to is that, you know, a lot of people are looking to escape. They see the inflation. I'm completely on board with everything about that. I think a lot of this had its roots in the Ron Paul campaign of 2008, people waking up to the Federal Reserve System and central banks and all this type of stuff. And, you know, it's obvious that they're just printing like crazy. I mean, it is nuts.
Oh, yeah.
So like a drunk with a credit card. What the hell are we going to do with this money?
Right.
So, you know, a lot of people have been demoralized in precious metals and other types of markets. And so they're running over to crypto. This is the new thing. And what it's going to be, I think, is going to be a showdown between, we know we're going to digital currency in one way or another. Okay. But it's going to be privatized currency versus government currency.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole question is who's going to win? Who's going to win? I mean, I think that there's a possibility that in the future there can be people that understand the crypto nerds or, you know, the cyberpunks and all, you know, that they know how to use it and they can use it on the edges. But if you want to talk about like just societal change, is everybody going to be using cryptocurrencies, or is, you know, the majority of people, 98% of people, are they going to be using central bank digital currencies?
Right.
I think that more than likely, most people are going to be using central bank digital currencies because they're statist.
Right.
In their head.
Right.
And they think that they have to, you know, they agree with taxes, they agree with everything. This is all something that they do because they're conditioned to do it. You know, and I would love to think that some technology could come and change everybody's mind about, you know, being governed. But it seems to me that a lot of people are more governable nowadays through the technologies and stuff like that. So,
right.
You know, the Davos crowd and all this, they sit around and pontificate and write white papers all day long about how they want to use digital currencies to surveil us and control us. And they had the whole blueprint. And so we know this. You can go look at it, read it. And there are a lot of people that know that. And it's going to be a battle. And so I really don't know how this whole thing's going to end up. But I think it's very interesting. And it's certainly a topic of interest right now. Mm-hmm. All over the internet, mm-hmm. All over my Twitter, I got laser eyes all over the place. And sometimes it's, you know, one of the most annoying things to me is like every time that there's a bull market in crypto, because, you know, I've been aware and involved with crypto, and a lot of people that are very involved in crypto for 10 years. And I've watched the ups and downs. And every time that there's a bull market, you get all these people that, like, you know, they just learned about crypto or learned about fiat currency and all this stuff like in the last 6 months or 3 months or whatever. And they're saying, oh, this is going to be, you know, this is going to save everything. And blah, blah. And if you, you know, say anything skeptical about anything whatsoever, then they just jump all over you. It's completely emotional, you know, and it's, I don't know. It's like, it's very silly. It's almost like, I think a lot of, I know people are going to get mad when I say this. You know, a lot of like QAnon, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot of people who are well-intentioned people, but maybe they didn't know about a lot of stuff.
Right.
And for some reason, they get this fire hose of alternative information, which some of it's true. A lot of it's not, and some of it, whatever. But they just like, oh, my God, and they got to tell everybody, and they think they know everything about it, and you don't know anything. When you've known about the things that are true for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's the same thing. I think a lot of people, when they first get into crypto, a lot of newbies, and a lot of people do it just because of greed, right? They don't care anything about liberty.
Right.
And this is one thing that really kind of annoys me when I see ball players and rappers and big corporations and all this stuff getting on board, and people are like, oh, this is so great. It's like, Jack Dorsey. Okay. I don't think Jack Dorsey's on my side as far as like wanting liberty for the people,
no.
or, you know, freedom of speech, all this type of stuff,
yeah.
for instance. But I mean, there's a whole list of people that I could talk about like that. So, just basically say all that to say, I don't know where the whole thing is going, but, it does kind of frustrate me the amount of hubris a lot of people get that just they know where it's going. They know, oh, no, $100,000, $100,000 Bitcoin, $100,000 in 6 months. They just pull that number out of their ass. You know what I mean? All of them. They pull all these numbers out of their ass. No, buy this. Trust me. You'll thank me later. Okay. And then if it goes down, what are you going to do? I mean, they just, they know nothing about technical analysis, fundamental analysis,
right.
You know, currency trading. And so at this point, it makes me very nervous. It seems kind of frothy, but who knows? I mean, you know, who knows where it'll go? But I think that we got a big showdown because the governments are coming for their ass. And, you know, they'll start at exchanges, you know, Coinbase, things like this. A lot of these newbies, that's what they're doing. They keep their money on the exchanges.
Right.
And they're going to fuck them up. And who knows how far. I mean, look what they've done to Ross Ulbricht, right? You know, you know, I was thinking this morning, I wonder if Ross Ulbricht was down here in Mexico or was in somewhere lost in Southeast Asia, if they would have got to him.
I wonder if they'd even, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, he was just a poster child for something they wanted to try to scare people away from doing.
Yeah.
That was all.
Yeah, but it worked. You know, that's the thing. They can use, it's like, you know, Lou Rockwell used this metaphor a long time ago that I really liked. He was talking about the government. He said, it's like you're trying to play soccer and there's a big bull, a big giant bull in the middle of the soccer ring. And it's like, yeah, you can move around the bull, but sometimes that bull is just going to maul a bunch of people.
Right,
it's a big,
right.
violent bull. And so, yeah, you can get around it, but sometimes people get mauled by the bull.
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyways, that's kind of...
Well, the one thing about crypto, and I would say this is a running theme amongst, say, many asset classes. Mm-hmm. People don't take the time to understand what they're buying, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
So if you understand, if you think that I don't understand computers, I don't understand technology, I don't know what a protocol is, I don't know anything about private keys. I don't know about how mining works. You shouldn't be buying crypto.
Yeah, I agree.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you're going to get wrecked.
Mm-hmm.
Period, you will. Because if some scam artist comes along and says, buy this shit coin, and you do it, it's on you, right? And the problem, I think, is that we've created this post-internet world in which people are no longer pragmatic thinkers.
Yeah.
They are faith-based ideologists. Mm-hmm. So, as you mentioned, you know, and it happens in politics and it happens in money, that their buddy tells them about something and, oh, they got to go and do it, right? No, they need to stop and look and research and read some books and study some things. And if you don't understand it, then don't buy it, right? I can understand real estate because I know what a brick looks like, right? It's easy.
Yeah.
I know what people need for their over their head. I understand gold because I went to Venice, Italy, into the world's first ever investment bank from the 1200s to study what that was.
I've been there too. Yeah.
Yeah, because I wanted to feel what the invention of banking was all about and why it exists.
I bought a gold chain on the Medici Bridge.
There you go.
There, yeah.
Right
yeah,
on.
That's nice, yeah.
And this is important because you get it, right? You get it. And all of a sudden, things start making sense. When people don't look and research at the reality of things like Bitcoin and just blindly spruik it to the moon, like, you know, let's Lambos and unicorns.
Yeah.
It irks me because this is exactly the same thing that happens before any bubble crash. The problem with so much of this market is that people don't understand the intersection between governments, geopolitics, and money. And the one thing that scares me the most about, and I'll use Bitcoin because I'm sure there are many other currencies out there, right? But I'll use Bitcoin because it's easiest. It's like the name brand of crypto, yeah. right? I checked the latest statistics I could find a couple of days ago. Now, when you mine Bitcoin, you use these computers. It used to be when I got into Bitcoin back in 2011, I could mine it on a laptop. And I did just because I wanted to understand what the protocol was, how peer-to-peer electronic cash worked, and what mining was all about. I went through that exercise. I learned it. I studied the code. I learned the whole thing. And it made sense because I was trying to use it as a medium of exchange. to pay somebody across the border without any intervention of a counterparty, a true peer-to-peer transaction. The promise of that is amazing for humanity. We could take of the 8 billion people on this planet, the 3 billion unbanked, and we can give them a smartphone and go, you got your bank in your pocket. That stuff excites me. That's good for people. The problem is nobody ever wanted to talk about that. They wanted to talk about price escalation and asset appreciation.
I used to like it back then because I could buy mushrooms and they would get delivered to my door.
Bingo. I had to pay a programmer in Bangladesh at the time when they thought anybody who lived in an Islamic country was a Satan or something. Right. But I could pay him.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it was like...
You could do a lot of stuff.
And why not? How dare they tell me that a good software developer isn't worth paying?
Right.
I mean, get out. Yeah. Come on.
Right.
So Bitcoin was great for that.
Yeah.
The problem was that the mining got more and more complicated. Eventually, you had to buy custom devices to mine, what they call ASICs, ASIC miners. And they came out of one company in the world for the most part. There was a couple, but eventually it all sort of amalgamated to one. A company called Bitmain out of China. Now, I have an interesting history with China because being an Australian, I've gone back to my home country over the past, I don't know, 10 years or so, and I've seen it turn into a province of China. Recently, in the last few years, there was a from China, and now they're like sworn enemies of each other. But back in those early days, I felt that the country of my birth had lost its identity because it had sold its natural resources out to China. And being a communist regime in China, it was kind of, why would you do that? It's juxtaposed to your moral principles to do that. They eventually woke up to themselves and detached. The problem was, over here they didn't, and they still haven't completely. Part of the reason why I'm here in Mexico is to assess how the supply chain migration is moving away from China and to Mexico. And it's doing it very, very fast and very strong. But I bring it back to Bitmain. So this company was making these devices to mine Bitcoin. In 2017, a very smart programmer in the United States decided that the firmware, which is the software burnt into the chips on these machines that runs the protocol that does the mining, that he could reverse or disassemble the code. It's a complicated thing you do in software development where you basically turn compiled code back into its source so you can look and see what it's doing. He did that and reported back to the Bitcoin community that he found these routines in there that would do things like if the mining was done in a certain IP range that was within the state of China, and particularly in the Bitmain's own mining centers, that it would increase performance and everybody else would get decreased performance. Why would you do that? Well, the way mining works is you get block rewards based on who basically solves the problem fastest. And if all of your mining equipment is geared towards China getting all the block rewards, guess where all the Bitcoin goes? To this day, 65% of the Bitcoin mining hash rate globally is done in China. 65%. The United States, about 7%. They subsidize power.
Yeah.
They have subsidized hardware. And they've rigged the game to their advantage and sold us the second-grade mining equipment for the rest of the world. If one country that is a communist regime controls the vast majority of the Bitcoin mining hash rate, how does Bitcoin end well? Because at any moment in time, they could decide to shut it off, completely take it over, co-opt the blockchain unto themselves. And in doing that, it completely destroys the efficacy of the currency. And at that point in time, it's no longer the original white paper electronic peer-to-peer cash system. It's turned from being a medium exchange to being a store of value. Now it's a store of value controlled by communist China.
Have they not tried to crack down, though?
No. In fact, the really bizarre thing about that is I looked at the charts over time, and I think at the probably 2016, 2017 period, they were probably closer to about 70 to 75% hash rate, and they've dropped to an amazing like 63 or 64 now. It's not helping.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be that you could mine in Iceland because they had cheap geothermal power, and many companies over there did. What was the biggest one? BitClub Network was one. Well, they got run by a bunch of scammers, and everyone lost their money.
I don't know what happened with that.
They were found to have been mining and keeping the proceeds, not giving it to their members. The government came in, basically shut them down and arrested everybody. Right. And the lead founder was found in Indonesia and convicted under a child pornography charge as well. It was really quite kind of bad. So like Joby Weeks, he was in jail for 6 months.
I know, but he's out now.
He just got out, but he's still waiting his sentencing.
Oh, is that?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I never knew what happened with that.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
I didn't know the details
bad.
About it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, but I think a lot of people are just thinking that, well, you know, we can just hop on to another, you know, a lot of people are on Pirate Chain and these other types of more security-based things. And
right.
I don't know. You know, again, the way that I look at it, I think that there's a possibility that you know, those will work, but if you want to talk about societal-wide, you know, I mean, I don't think that Bitcoin's going to be the new global currency, you know what I mean, for instance. Although, you know, who knows what will happen in the future. Okay, so everybody's concentrating on crypto and all this type of stuff, but there's got to be other things in the real world. You know what I was also going to say is that, interrupt that thought, there could be a possibility that a lot of these digital currencies do, you know, become very successful, take over everything and all that, but they're useful in this, in a digital world. So, you know, we talk about NFTs and all this type of stuff. I know that Real Vision, they're very bullish on cryptos and all this type of stuff. And, you know, I heard this Raoul Paul guy, you know, he was saying how he's so cool that, you know, a lot of young people, they instead of going out, they'd be in their room, you know, socializing with their friends and all that type of stuff and trading with digital currencies. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a possibility that, like, in 10 years, everybody's, like, plugged in a pod to Facebook and trading their, you know, digital real estate, like a digital condo that they live in their virtual reality. Okay, yeah, maybe that, but I don't know if that doesn't seem like a world that I mean, maybe, you know, I'll just be like a caveman at that point and just get killed or something. But
is that good for humans?
Yeah, right.
You know, I was telling somebody the other day, when I first started writing computer software, it was, I think, about 1978. I was a kid in my bedroom writing this stuff, and typical nerd kid. And I thought that these things were amazing, that, you know, I could tell a machine to do something and it would do it. And it was like, oh, how powerful is that for like a 15-year-old kid, right? What I found over time is that as I made a career out of writing software for people, I started learning that you have to first learn, if you want to write something to help somebody out, you have to understand what we in the software world will call the requirements of what you're doing. There's an art to understanding what that is. It's a psychological game. People who do the same thing all day, every day, it's kind of like forest and trees, right? They're looking at the tree like this. They don't see the forest of what's really going on about them. So if you go to them and say, well, I hear you need a system for automating some manufacture in your factory. Tell me about it. And they go, yeah, I clean the floor. I'm the janitor. I can't tell you anything about the rest of it.
Right.
And you go to the guy there, I work on work center ABC, but I don't know anything about what happens to the stuff after it leaves my work center. And you talk about the guy in the shipping dock and he'll go, yeah, I take the finished goods and I put them in the truck, but I don't know how they got finished. And then you live in this world of like Mr. Detective, you've got to work it all out. And you learn these like psychological human experiments to ask the right questions, to find out what it is. You learn how to analyze and design things and model things to make sure you didn't miss something. That was the skills that existed before 1995, and they were very strong in software development because the whole point was software was there to meet a human need, right? In 1995, we invented the thing called the internet. When we did that, we changed the world because all of a sudden, you couldn't go to a human being and say, what do you need? Because they'd look at you and go, I don't know. The world's changed. What's this Amazon? I don't know. I never thought that would happen. What's Twitter? What's a tweet? I don't know. What's Facebook? I don't know. Why? Because the programmers, the nerds, all of a sudden usurped the human and said, look, I don't care what you need. I'm going to give you what you want and you're going to like it. So I'm going to give you YouTube. I'm going to give you Facebook. I'm going to give you Twitter. I'm going to give you Amazon. I'm going to give you eBay. I'm going to give you Tesla. I'm going to give you all this stuff and you're going to love it. What if you don't? And the problem is, what if that nerd who created it, and look, they're good people in all industries, right? But what if they become so powerful because now they are the architects of the future?
Right.
Do you think that somebody who has a human social inadequacy, who's unable to form solid, good human relationships, that is responsible for large-scale groups of people that have all the skills that are normally found in people who are raised or maybe they came from the military and they understand what teams are about and they understand, you know, the responsibility of you know, when you could lose your life if you screw up, things like that. These nerds don't come from that. They're the guys in the schoolyard that you sort of laughed at when you were at school, you know, and yet they've got this, they've now got an axe to grind and they've got this power. Because they are the architects of the future. We've given up everything to them. I worked with these guys
probably
for 40
years.
Probably
would have been school shooters like 20 years ago.
Right. But I'm not saying they're all like that. But yeah. I'm saying you name Zuckerberg, right. Dorsey, Elon Musk, and you tell me
Bill
they're
Gates.
Not psychologically flawed in some fashion.
Right.
Because if they were perfect psychological human beings, they probably wouldn't be doing what they're doing.
Mm.
And my concern is that we as a society...
A high level of Asperger's as well.
Yeah. And we as a society have given all of our power to them and said, we don't care what we want. You give us whatever you say. And Elon, if you say Bitcoin or Dogecoin or whatever, we're just following you all the way until he says, yeah, that was a joke.
Yeah.
And we're like,
right.
Let us down, you know. This is the world that no one takes responsibility for anything. No one sees humans for what humans are and the good of what humans can do and the responsibility that we all must have and looking after each other and all the things that we were taught as kids, like, you know, sharing if you've got an abundance of something or helping somebody out if they're broken down on the side of the road. No one does that crap anymore.
Mm.
We just look at our smartphones and go, whatever he says.
Right.
And that's my concern. And part of the reason why I love coming here is because I get back to a basic society in which humans matter,
sure.
Families matter, people care for each other. They are self-responsible. They don't run to the government to solve their problems.
Yeah.
You know, they're individually self-responsible. And I guarantee they wouldn't be out there buying Bitcoin if they didn't understand what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess that there have been some, like... some remittances. I don't know how much, but I've read some articles about a lot of remittances now. Instead of using Western Union, they're using different types of crypto. And so that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And in other countries, I guess, where...
medium of exchange.
Yeah.
The original promise.
Right. That seems to be completely lost for the most part. I mean, you know, now everybody just talks about it being digital gold.
Yeah.
Bitcoin itself. But I think that this is also kind of an impasse. I did a live stream the other day when I was talking about, you know, it could be that, you know, again, when you look at this series, Ralph Paul that I mentioned, the exponential age that he's been talking about lately, and then you look at people like Catherine Austin Fitz, who says basically all these people are spending their time building their own prison, very anti, also the wrench in the gears lady, I forget her name, and... they're basically saying all the people that, you know, they're freedom oriented, they're concentrating all their time on crypto and blockchain and all this, they're building their own prison because this is all going to be used to track us and monitor us and all that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When I hear the very, very bullish people who are saying this is great that new giant institutions are coming on board and all these other people coming on board, and so they're positive about it, I think that they both could be right in that it just matters what you feel or what do you think about this new world that's coming about.
Right.
You know, maybe, you know, they're right. That it is, everything's going to go, you know, shooting through the roof and everything's going to be exponential, but it's going to be this completely digitized, technocratic world that a lot of people are just not going to like at a fundamental level. And I'm sure that a lot of the people that are looking into the, you know, the futurists and all that stuff know that. and know that there's going to be, you know, they write about a giant portion of the population that aren't going to accept it and just basically be cast to the side. And
there might also be something to be said for a last-ditch attempt to try to get my piece of the pie.
Yeah.
Right? Because we all know that if you continue down the downward spiral that we have turned technology into,
mm-hmm.
that what ends up happening is you fall into this world where the robots control us.
Right.
The singularity
yeah.
principle, big data, all the things that are on the surface sound interesting, programmers love, and they get all, you know, highfalutin about. But at the end of the day, they're mechanisms, they're weapons
yeah.
that can be used against society to predict where you're going to be, to predict what you're going to do, to be there when you before you know you need something. These things are not good. And at the end of the day, I think that eventually the human being knows that 65% of the existing workforce out there will be made obsolete
mm-hmm.
by robotics, technology. My wife was showing me a story about a friend of ours who just got himself a job working for a company that makes autonomous trucks that drive from Tucson, Arizona to Los Angeles yeah. and back.
That's how it starts, the autonomous driving.
Yeah, well, trucks. I mean, if, what, 17% of the world's employment is in the transport industry.
Yeah.
How do you recover from that?
Yeah.
Because I guarantee that the owners of the big trucking companies don't want humans. Mm-hmm. Humans need motivation and sick leave and holiday pay and unions and all yeah. that crap. No, let's just get a robot.
Yeah.
So if that's the world of the, say, the college graduate today is looking down the barrel at that and going, I don't know if there is a career for me 10 years from now. I
yeah.
don't know what I'm going to do. I have to learn some skills and pivot and pivot and pivot and pivot and pivot. Maybe I should just, like, get some Bitcoin and go and play video games on Twitch or something. I mean,
right.
whatever. Because where's the hope?
Yeah.
Right? And I think, I'm not saying that, but it feels to me like we're living in this one big Black Mirror episode.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't really use critical analysis anymore, pragmatic thinking, or what's good for us as people.
Yeah.
We just say, he said something, I'm going with that.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, another, you know, when we're talking about all this, another thing that you could just think about is actual skills. You know, when you're talking about how probably a lot of people here won't be as affected by, you know, these types of things. You know, it's amazing after you spend time in Latin America, Mexico specifically, you know, they really still have the idea of like skills with their hands. Like I can grab any, you know, guy to help me at the house. He knows plumbing, electricity, building. How we got guys building a house right here, you know, with very, you know, little equipment. You know, they can do all kinds of stuff, and it's really amazing. But the stuff that they kind of do, they can do. You know, sometimes if I've had a problem with my car before, you know, I remember just sitting there trying to figure out what I'm going to do, and the only thing I want is some old school Mexican guy to come by and fix it for me because I know he can do it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right.
And so I think that, you know, we'll see how things eventually end up. But it could help to get some proficiency and some sort of real, you know, skills with your hands, trade, things like this. And even things like gardening and you know, working on getting your own land and things like this. And so, you know, getting your definitely getting some sort of an income with investments or business sales you can do online and that kind of stuff. But also think about, you know, getting some of that money, maybe cashing out some of the crypto gains, getting, you know, some land, get, you know, and using that to also take some time to learn some real life skills and things like that.
I think people have to study yeah. things like Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
And they have to look at what are physiological needs that all humans require: food, shelter, clothing.
Yeah.
Start in that market. My biggest industry is shelter.
Yeah.
That's where I work. Maybe food and clothing, water, medicine, health, transportation, telecommunications. Those sort of infrastructural utility needs are always going to be required.
Yeah.
If you have skills in those areas, you can go through a great reset.
Yeah.
And look, it's not – how many times do we see on – in the liberty movement, how do we see it in general population, the likes of people like Doug Casey predicting these kind of events. And if I go back, I went back in out of the pure interest, I went back to 1980
yeah. and found him being interviewed.
With Donahue?
Phil Donahue, yeah.
And he said everything was wrong.
Everything, and I looked at everything he said.
Yeah.
It was like tick, 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 tick. I mean, the timing might have been a little off here and there. But, yeah, it was like, okay, and so if this is a guy who moves himself to Uruguay and looks upon the world as being...
Oh, you're saying he was right, but it just behind the times?
Yeah,
oh,
his timing was off, but his end points were pretty close to right on. And there's so many factors in this that are part of the human experience that we don't... We kind of need to understand that maybe we're going through a moment like a fourth turning,
mm-hmm.
something along those lines, where it's depressing as it might be. Empires, they rise and fall.
Right.
The Roman, the Greeks, you know, the French with Napoleon, the British,
right.
and maybe the American.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's now time for us to accept that we're not always going to be able to just speculate and it's always right.
Yeah.
That eventually bull markets run out and we have to get back to pragmatic reality. And if the worst possible case scenario is that our governments have not led us in the right direction in terms of debt obligation, tax policy, defense, all of these things that we've been going down the wrong path, and they all of a sudden have to do a 180 degree and we're all going to end up paying for that. At that point in time, you wonder whether or not we can. We're so down the path of like $30 trillion of short-term debt obligation and $150 trillion of future debt obligation that it's very, very hard to find a way out of that mess.
Right. No, it's completely unsustainable.
Yeah.
There's going to be some point in time when, you know, the Fed cannot just continue to print money and export inflation. And all this MMT, UBI, you know, my thing is nonsense.
Right.
They're just coping with the fact that all they can do is just continue to monetize debt, print money, and it can't happen. There's going to be a change, so we'll have to see how it goes. I think it's going to be very hard for many, many people. You know, again, the timing thing. You know, I've been listening to Doug Casey, even Harry Brown. You know, in the 70s. And, you know, it's lasted a lot longer than a lot of Austrians have thought. It's lasted a lot longer than I thought, you know.
Right.
But, the fact is, you know, math exists. And it's just, you know, laws of the universe. You can't just continue to print money and live off that. And the rest of the world is going to give you their goods. And they're going to be working for you to give them their debt. And so we'll see how it all plays out. But, you know, how we've talked about, you know, in Borderless, you know, the idea of kind of positioning yourself and thinking beyond your own psychological and physical borders to where you think you could position yourself better and all that kind of thing. You know, I feel like here, you know, where I am, I have a good network of people.
Right.
And there's a lot of people that are used to having to really work hard and not having any debt and doing things with their hands. And a lot of people that are used to being poor. And so it's not going to be also a lot more decentralization, a lot more food that comes from local sources,
mm-hmm.
And things like that. And so I think it wouldn't be as big of a, if there was a currency crisis, an energy crisis, some sort of economic problem or whatever, that it's not the same type of panic you have in the United States also because of all the people with, you know, political things at their throat already, a multicultural, you know, kind of a ethnic thing at each other's throats, all kinds of things that people are mad at each other for a variety of reasons. They don't see themselves in any way. I think they basically, you have people living in the same geographical territory, but I mean, it's obvious they have completely different foundations, you know, belief systems, moral systems, the you know, historical narratives, you know, because we all have historical narratives, you know, and so that's kind of how societies are, you know, whether you like it or not, you know, societies get together that have the basic moral belief in something and historical narrative to how they got there and all that type of stuff. And so if they have completely contradicting historical narratives and they're all living it, I mean, that's going to create conflict, I think, and you know, So I see a lot of that coming in the West, the United States, and any type of economic hardship is going to really make it even worse.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in Arizona during the election, the recent election,
yeah,
and to see the militarization of just private citizens on the street supporting their guy or this guy, and the whole thing was like, well, it's like a WWE match.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It wasn't. No one was real.
Yeah.
The whole thing was just this fictitious theatrical event, but people took it so viscerally.
Yeah.
You know, and they did it that way, I think, because they shared something in common, and that was this belief that hope is lost, or that the opportunities were not being distributed out evenly, and that this color of skin or that color of skin or this economic class or this belief or religion or whatever was always getting shafted out of something. And at the end of the day, everyone felt like they were losing, where when I look at it from an outsider, from an immigrant, it's like, what are you guys complaining about?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I get it. And it just became this ideological, almost religious fervor thing that could have been so close to a complete burning of society and breakdown that every single time I see an election cycle, I see it amplified. And at some point, it can't get any worse than that.
Right.
And it turns into all-out conflict.
Yeah.
And you have to ask yourself, what is driving this? It seems to me it's got nothing to do with red versus blue. These guys are actors on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's the people behind the scenes pulling the levers, and the ones that seem to be most likely to follow party A to party B, back to party A, back to party B, are the banks.
Yeah.
And I look at the whole thing and think to myself, this has got to be an orchestrated, an event for wealth redistribution.
Yeah.
And I just don't know exactly.
Well, it's pretty.
How or whatever, but it just seems that way.
It's pretty easy. I mean, for the media to stoke up this type of resentment, you know, it's just complete bullshit.
Yeah.
A lot of times, you know, now it's just accepted that the media can just print complete bullshit to get people mad at each other.
Totally.
And meanwhile, you know, last year, I mean, was it $4 or $5 trillion? You know, the biggest corporations are getting. You know, and so, yeah, I mean, you have all the lower classes fighting with each other over things that don't even matter. What do they care?
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, they're laughing all the way to the bank.
One thing I always laugh at, but people forget to look at this. I periodically will watch, like, the network news in the States. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that CBS are particularly good at this. There's a pre-programmed screenplay that goes on at 6 p.m. every night on the national news. And it kind of goes like this. You tell these shock and awe stories, like breaking news or whatever it is, COVID, war, economic hardship, whatever it is, shock and awe. And then you start running the ads. And then you look at the relationship between the media content and the ads. And I swear there is such an obvious thing here. The media shock and awe tells you about all of the problems. The ads are pharmaceutical companies, big pharma, insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
And what have insurance companies and big pharma have in common? Well, you need insurance because the world's coming to an end, and you need to talk to your doctor because I've got the magic pill to solve what the news just told you about. These things are directly in league. These TV stations are ad distribution mechanisms with content interjected between the advertising.
Mm-hmm.
They know that. It doesn't matter if you're Fox, CNN. They're all about, it's all about the ads. It's got nothing to do with the content. All we need to do is keep people triggered.
Right.
Okay, they might be triggered this way or that way. Just keep them triggered.
Mm-hmm.
And now the mainstream network news media realizes that is the business model. And that is what we need to do. So you tell somebody all about the problems, the advertising offers the solution. You tell somebody about the problems, the advertising offers the solution.
A lot of the stations now, they don't even have the ads. So what does that tell you? They're still receiving the money.
Yeah, well, so, that's like clickbait.
Well, no, because the ads are in what the anchor is saying.
Oh, good point.
So if the pharmaceutical company is paying 90%, you know, funding the 90%, but there's no pharmaceutical ads, well, so what does that mean? So, you know, they are slanting you towards them in some way.
Yeah.
You know, that is the ad, is what they're reporting. or at least it's slanted in some way in their favor.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, anyways, all right. Well, let's. I think we've talked about a lot here. Let's get going and go have some dinner. And it's great to have you on Borderless, and great to have you in San Miguel. All right. So, what do you think? Will you? You thinking about coming down to San Miguel, or what? Are your plans?
I think for us, it was we needed a place to have as a lack of a better term, a bug out location.
Yeah,
it's one. But the more that we spend time in San Miguel, the more we love it here, and the more likely we think of this as being maybe where we want to move our physical presence to for the majority of time. We're not exactly sure. My wife and I are still in that exploratory process, and we can take our time. We're lucky enough to be in a position because we're financially sustainable. We can do whatever we want.
Okay.
I don't think I've found too many places in the world that have the beauty of this place, mm-hmm. the weather, and just the people are fantastic. It's very rare to find that.
Yeah.
And I've traveled all over the world, and I haven't found it too many other places.
Cool. All right, well, it'd be good to have you.
Thank you.
Well, Miles, thanks, and thanks, everybody, for watching.
Thanks for joining us for the Borderless Podcast, traveling, investing, and living beyond borders.